It is 3 hours Universal Time. Stay tuned for Daybreak Africa coming up after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Ray Kugel reporting. Search underway for hundreds of migrants missing in the Mediterranean Sea. Italy launched a massive search and rescue operation in the Mediterranean Sunday after an overcrowded boat carrying hundreds of migrants capsized off the coast of Libya. As many as 700 people are feared dead. By nightfall Sunday, authorities said 28 people had been rescued about 200 kilometers south of the Italian island of Lampedusa, and another 24 bodies were recovered. Rescue workers said the majority of the missing appeared trapped in the 20-meter vessel at the bottom of the sea.
Ceux qui mettent des personnes sur des bateaux.
Speaking on French television Sunday, President François Hollande said officials must fight the human smugglers who put those migrants on their dangerous voyages. European leaders call for immediate action to resolve the migrant crisis. The White House is condemning in the strongest terms the mass murder of 30 Ethiopian Christians in Libya, claimed by Islamic State. A spokeswoman said Sunday the killings show the urgent need for a political settlement to the chaos in Libya and a unified rejection of terrorist groups. In claiming responsibility for the massacre, Islamic State posted a graphic video showing men kneeling on a beach and beheaded. Others are shot in the back of the head. An Arab League official told the French news agency that military chiefs from the region will meet this week in Cairo to discuss creating a joint military force against Islamic State militants. Iran's supreme leader lashed out at the United States Sunday, accusing Washington of inventing the myth of Tehran's nuclear weapons threat. Ayatollah Ali Khamenei also urged defensive preparedness for Iranian armed forces after a top U.S. general warned last week about military action against Tehran's nuclear sites. This is VOA News. The African Union mission to Somalia confirms that three Burundian soldiers were killed Sunday by al-Shabaab militants when their convoy was attacked in the town of Ligo in lower Shabelle region. An al-Shabaab spokesman said five soldiers were killed. The governor of Somalia's lower Shabelle region told VOA Somali at least 11 al-Shabaab militants were killed during the exchange of heavy fire. Last week, al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the bombing that left 18 dead at the higher education ministry in Mogadishu. Earlier this month, the militant group staged an attack on Kenya's Garissa University College, killing 148 people. Islamic State militants may be making a move in Afghanistan. The group claims it was behind a suicide bombing in eastern Afghanistan that killed 35 people Saturday and wounded more than 100 others. Ayaz Ghul has details.
Even though the terrorist group has not formally acknowledged its presence in Afghanistan, local authorities and media have in recent weeks reported the emergence of pro-Islamic fighters waving its black flag. The insurgents have claimed the kidnapping of Afghans, including security personnel, and released video images showing the killing of some hostages. But Saturday's suicide bombing in Jalalabad was the most lethal act of violence the group's Afghan allies have claimed. President Ashraf Ghani, in a nationally televised speech hours later, repeated the claims by the attackers, fueling fears the group is making inroads into Afghanistan. He has on previous occasions warned that IS could attempt to establish bases in his country. Ayaz Ghul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A new UN report says Afghanistan's judicial system is still failing women, even with the Islamic fundamentalist Taliban out of power. The report says only 5% of cases of violence against women result in punishment for the criminals. The report also says many Afghan women are financially dependent on the men who attack them. About 1,000 people gathered Sunday at the former site of the Oklahoma City Federal Building in the United States to mark the 20th anniversary of the terrorist bombing there that killed 168 people. Former President Bill Clinton, U.S. Attorney General Eric Holder, and the Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon spoke. President Obama sent a message saying the passage of time will never extinguish the pain. It was on April 19, 1995, that anti-government militant Timothy McVeigh parked a truckload of explosives in front of the Alfred P. Murrah Federal Building and set it off. The blast was strong enough to damage buildings for 16 blocks. That attack was the deadliest act of domestic terrorism in American history. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 20th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Liberia's president says her meeting with President Barack Obama met the expectations of the three West African countries hardest hit by Ebola.
We think what was more important is that the response to our call was positive, and everyone said these countries deserve the help.
That's President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf of Liberia. Burkina Faso's parliament gives details why officials of former President Blaise Compaoré's government cannot take part in presidential election this year. A new report released today details abuses of Senegal's child beggars, and the DRC government says the fate of detained human rights activists is in the hands of the judiciary.
Amnesty International is well aware that as far as judicial issues are concerned, the government cannot interfere. We are not the one in charge of judiciary.
Lambert Mende is the Democratic Republic of Congo's information minister, and the week-long Asia-Africa 60th anniversary commemoration conference opened yesterday in Jakarta, Indonesia. Those stories plus Mark Oldman's post and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf says the meeting she and the presidents of Guinea and Sierra Leone had with U.S. President Barack Obama met their expectations. Mr. Obama hosted the three leaders at the White House last week to discuss the fight against Ebola and the progress made. The three countries have been hardest hit by the Ebola disease. In an interview with viewer Shaka Sally, Mrs. Sirleaf said President Obama reassured her that the United States will continue to support Liberia as it embarks on its economic recovery plans. She also said she is hopeful that some of the $1.4 billion the United States has allocated to fight Ebola can be used to support the economic recovery program.
The Congress had already appropriated a certain amount to fight Ebola, and out of that, there was $1.4 billion. That's supposed to be allocated to the three countries. Now, of course, as you know, that allocation we don't have all the details on, and a lot of it go to U.S. institutions that have been involved in working with us to fight the disease. We made more progress, you know, than had been anticipated when these estimates were made. And what I take it as something concrete is that President Obama said, we recognize the progress. What we'd like to do now is to see how some of that allocation that may not be used can now be shifted to support your economic recovery program.
So would it be fair then to say that the meeting really met your expectations?
The meeting met our expectations. He was very firm in his statement of support. If I may just use a phrase he used, he said, I would like for the United States to make your three countries successful coming out of this dreadful disease. And I think that's a strong statement.
I see. Well, you also had meetings with the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. And I gather that you had requested for anywhere between $5 to $6 billion. How did that meeting go? Because reports suggest that the World Bank actually has agreed to offer $650 million.
Well, let's put this in context. We said we'd like to see what we call a Marshall Plan. A Marshall Plan means a pooling of international resources toward the objective of helping the three countries on their economic recovery road. Our rough back-of-the-envelope estimate came to about $8.8 billion, $4 billion of which is original program, and the other four are attributed to the three countries' national development program. And so we're looking at taking some of the existing commitments that come from not just the World Bank Group, but our European partners, our other multilateral partners, African Development Bank, International Monetary Fund, the whole range of supports. So when the World Bank said $650 million, that is additionality because the bank had already made commitments to each of us in this fight for some of our program and to each of us in our own development, national development programs. Well, I think what was more important is that the response to our call was positive. And everyone said these countries deserve the help, not only because we've been through this, but because we have to prepare our health systems to have the resistance and the capacity to respond to this, because this is not a West Africa threat. It's a global threat.
That's Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf speaking in an interview with VOA's Shaka Sale. A spokesman for the Democratic Republic of Congo's government said the fate of human rights activists arrested earlier this month for holding a meeting is in the hands of the Congolese judicial system and not the government. This comes as Amnesty International called on the government to immediately and unconditionally release about 30 activists arrested March 15th while attending a press conference after a workshop on youth civic engagement in political processes. Amnesty says the arrest shows the DRC government's continued crackdown on peaceful assembly before next year's presidential election. But Information Minister Lambert Mende says Amnesty should address its concerns to the Congolese judicial system.
Amnesty International is well aware that as far as judicial issues are concerned, the government cannot interfere. Let Amnesty address to the judiciary, maybe they will get an answer. We are not the one in charge of judiciary.
But it says that your government beat those people up and probably arrested them.
Of course, when it rains, it is the government. When it is not raining, it is the government when you follow Amnesty. Of course, police can arrest people and give them to the judiciary. And when those people are in the hands of judiciary, the government cannot interfere. I think it is the same in the country where you are living. So please stop disturbing the government. It is a judiciary issue. Address to the judiciary. Leave the government alone.
How come, Mr. Minister, you were able to release the foreigners, Burkinabes and others, and you are not able to release the Congolese?
It is the Congolese law that allowed the president to decide to stop an issue before the judiciary take it in hand. They were lucky enough that their head of state interfered before the judiciary take it in hand. It was just in the prosecution, and they were freed according to Congolese law. I have not to explain to you the Congolese law or to appear before I don't know which court to explain. That is our law. That is what it was. That is the way it is made. We are not colonized by I don't know who. I'm just explaining to you what is the provision of our law. It was applied, and that is all.
Mr. Minister, what can you tell us? Our correspondent in, I think, Goma reported about a mass grave. Is there a mass grave in the country or somewhere in Kinshasa or in the Goma area?
Oh, you are in confusion then. There is a false story of a mass grave in Kinshasa. It is clear that it was just people who lack assistance from their family, baby who were killed by their mothers, you know, these young girls getting pregnant and fearing their parents. They are giving birth and throwing their babies. It is common in Kinshasa. And the Kinshasa town, as any other town, is, you know, taking the duty to those people, et cetera. So that is what the opposition tried to take opportunity. But I think everything came out to that there is no crime that was committed. It is just the business of hospital and the municipality as usual. The state is not concerned. There was not any crime about it.
Lambert Mende is Information Minister of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was speaking with me from the capital, Kinshasa. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I am James Butte in Washington. Today is Monday, April 20th, and please send your comments and opinions to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. Let's give a shout-out to listeners on these, our VOA affiliate stations, Buffalo FM in Monrovia, Liberia, Brela FM in Nigeria, Kisi FM in Tanzania, Capital FM in Blantyre, Malawi, and Kira FM in Jinja, Uganda. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 15 minutes past the hour. A growing number of children are being forced to beg on the streets of Dakar under the guise of attending alleged Quranic schools, according to several social workers in Senegal. Human Rights Watch is today, Monday, releasing a report citing a number of abuses made by adults claiming to act as Quranic teachers, including physical beatings and forcing children to beg, despite a 10-year-old law that outlaws forced begging. A government census found more than 30,000 boys are being subjected to forced begging in the Dakar region each day. Human Rights Watch's West Africa researcher Felicity Thompson tells Ricky Strike that Senegal needs to uphold its current rules against forced begging.
10 years ago, this month, Senegal passed a law to protect children from being forced to beg, which was a good law, but it has very rarely been put into action. We have found a handful of cases where Quranic school teachers who forced their students to beg were actually held to account and convicted of this crime. Regular cases of talibé abuse are regular beatings, whipping with ropes or even metal cords, and a recent case in Saint Louis in March, where a 7-year-old boy had been chained with metal chains around his ankles to prevent him from running away from his Quranic school, which he had done several times to try and escape the abuses that he was suffering there.
Is it an issue of the government not having enough resources to investigate and properly prosecute these cases?
There is a question of resources, and the government putting enough resources into, for example, the anti-trafficking units that they set up to look at this problem. But also, you can walk anywhere on the street in Senegal and you can see talibé begging quite openly in front of police and in front of, you know, public buildings. So you don't need resources to apply that law to investigate, you know, those children who are begging on the streets.
Where is the resistance coming from, do you think?
One of the main problems we found is opposition from religious leaders and social pressure, because the Quranic schools are such a long tradition in Senegal. But the Quranic schools that we are talking about are not those traditional Quranic schools. They're businesses that have been set up by people who aren't necessarily Quranic teachers, but under the guise of that institution, they are committing these crimes. Human Rights Watch has been researching this issue of abuses of talibé for about 5 years. And despite, you know, some efforts by the government, there's really been little change since then. It's not a small problem, and it's not a problem that's going away. In fact, our recent research shows that it's a growing phenomenon.
The Quranic schools are not regulated in Senegal. There are efforts to pass a draft law in the Senegalese legislature right now that would regulate Quranic schools, but there is some speculation that that draft law might be abandoned after years of effort. What is the status of that draft law right now?
As far as the official status of the draft law to regulate daras or Quranic schools in Senegal, it's currently under consultation before going to the National Assembly.
Felicity Thompson is a West Africa researcher for Human Rights Watch. She was speaking to Ricky Shryak from Dakar, Senegal. An advisor to the Speaker of Burkina Faso's interim parliament has been given new details about a controversial law which bars officials of former President Blaise Compaoré's government from contesting the October 2015 presidential election. Article 135 of the controversial law states that any person who in any way acted or thought to bring about unconstitutional change in government should not be allowed to participate in the election. Issaka Traoré, advisor to the Speaker of Parliament, says the ban is in line with the African Charter on Democracy, Elections and Governance, which has been ratified by Burkina Faso.
This particular article of the electoral law, in fact, is based on and relying on the African Charter on Democracy, Election and Governance, mainly on Article 25 and 24 of this Charter of the African Union. So what the National Council of Transition did is not something new. We just applied and transposed the international conventions that the government of Burkina Faso ratified in 2008 by the government of Blaise Compaoré. So it's not even the transition that ratified this chart. The government of Blaise Compaoré that ratified this chart. So we are just putting this international norm into practice in our national laws.
Well, some people would say that is very undemocratic. To prevent them from not taking part is undemocratic.
It's not undemocratic. You know, the last time with the international community, there was a meeting, you know, every 2 months, they came here in Ouagadougou for a meeting to meet all the stakeholders that are involved in the transition. And we asked the African Union about the Charter and Article 25. And the African Union said, well, if you apply the Charter and the Article 25, then you are right. You know, these people cannot complain. And they were so disappointed that they left the discussion table. So, you know, it's just a propaganda, a very, very bad propaganda that they are doing. It's not something new. And, you know, the former ruling party, CDP, they can present any candidate they want, but there are too many risks for them. If you present those who were really involved in the change of the Article 37 of the Constitution that led to the uprising and the overthrow of Blaise Compaoré, these people will not be allowed to run the election because people will contest it at the constitutional court. That's the first thing. And also the second thing is that they have the opportunity to present other candidates, those who are not so famous on this idea of supporting Blaise Compaoré to change the rule of the game. So it's up to them to feel what they want to do. But we are not saying that CDP or any other party who were supporting Blaise Compaoré cannot run for the election. This is not what the law says.
Isaka, is there any kind of message that you think other African countries who may be in similar situation like Burkina Faso, is there a particular message they can draw from this?
Well, as far as any African country who ratified the African Charter of Democracy, Election and Governance, if they came across to have the same situation like our country in Burkina Faso, they can also apply Article 25 of the African Charter of Democracy, Election and Governance. You know, it's not unconstitutional. It's not something that goes against the law as far as your country has ratified that charter.
I hear that the supporters of the former president are trying to protest this decision.
Yes. You know, they even decided that they will suspend their participation to the National Council of the Transition. They have 2 MPs there. But the MPs said that they are not concerned about this suspension. So this is democracy. They can go in court and then the court will decide who is right, who is wrong.
Isaka Traore is the advisor to the Speaker of Burkina Faso's interim parliament. He was speaking with me from the capital, Ouagadougou. The week-long Asia-Africa Conference 60th anniversary commemoration opened Sunday in Jakarta with representatives from 77 countries in attendance and over 30 heads of state expected to participate. The Indonesian organizers see the conference as means to increase development and cooperation programs between developing countries.
The first Asia-Africa conference was held in Bandung, Indonesia in 1955 to advocate for liberation from colonial rule and resist undue influence from the two major superpowers, the United States and the Soviet Union. At the 60th anniversary commemoration in Jakarta and Bandung, Indonesian Foreign Ministry spokesman Armanata Nasir says the focus this time is different.
I think the major theme is development. It's ensuring that the people of Asia and Africa rose away from poverty, reducing the development gaps between Asia and Africa.
The original Asia-Africa conference led to the founding of the Non-Aligned Movement. With the end of the Cold War, some analysts questioned the multinational organization's relevance. Its meetings often produced anti-Western rhetoric but no cooperative programs. This year, Indonesian President Joko Widodo wants to give developing nations a new framework based on cooperation and development. During the conference, the Indonesian organizers will promote increasing South-South cooperation, a term that means direct cooperation among developing countries, and triangular cooperation that involves developing countries working alongside advanced Western countries to provide assistance. Dian Triansyah Yani, a high-ranking official in Indonesia's foreign ministry, highlighted how his country, with funding and support from Norway, is providing 45 assistance programs to Afghanistan in the fields of health, education, and agriculture, among others. He says no one country can do it alone.
The needs are quite vast, and the programs that are expected to be undertaken is so large that a country like Indonesia would not be sufficient, or any developing country would not be sufficient enough to not also cooperate with other colleagues from the developed countries.
Norway's ambassador to Jakarta, Stig Travik, says countries in the Islamic world can more easily relate to Indonesia's experience in development and democracy as the world's largest Muslim-majority country.
Indonesia is a superpower in one area, and that is in pragmatism, tolerance, and moderation.
Organizers say also they want to increase the power and influence of developing countries in the United Nations, although China, France, Russia, Britain, and the United States hold veto power as permanent members of the Security Council. Later in the week, the heads of state from China, Japan, South Africa, Ethiopia, and Pakistan are scheduled to address the conference. Brian Patton, VOA News, Jakarta.
It's 25 minutes past the hour. Time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. And here is Mark Owoma in Johannesburg, South Africa. Very good Monday morning to you, Mark.
Good morning, James. In our Daybreak Africa Sports News, we focus on the South Africa Senior Athletics Championship staged in Stellenbosch, Western Cape Province. Stephen Mokoka stole the limelight when he won the 5,000 meters in a new national record of 13 minutes and 10.89 seconds on Saturday. Despite qualifying in 5,000 meters for the World Athletics Championships due in Beijing, China in August, Mokoka insists he's focused on qualifying for the 10,000 meters at the IAAF Diamond League in Eugene, Oregon State in the United States of America in June.
With Eugene now, it's a matter of trying to qualify because my main aim at the World Championships, I want to run 10,000. I have to go there in a rational pace so that I can be able to try and run the qualifier there because I want to focus on the 10,000 at the World Championships.
There you may not have your teammates to help you with the pace. Do you feel that you'll still be able to do it even though your training partners who help you out today will not be there?
I mean, at Prefontaine, it's all about Nike runners, so those guys are very fast. I think they are going 26 pace, so I will just try to find a proper group for myself so that I can follow them all the way till I go to the finish. So my main aim is just to try to follow them. I mean, with my own pace, I hope I'll be able to cope with that so that I can be able to run the qualifier 27:45.
That was Stephen Mokoka, South Africa's new 5,000-meter record holder, speaking in Stellenbosch. Meanwhile, 10 more athletes attained the qualifiers for the World Championships. They are sprinters Anaso Jobodwana and Wade Fanny Kirk in the men's 200 meters and 400 meters respectively. Long jumper Rashwal Samai, shot putters Orazio Cremona and Yako Engelbrecht, together with the men's 20-kilometer race walkers Lebohang Shange and Wayne Sneyman. Louis Van Sale and Wenda Nell qualified for the men's and women's 400-meter hurdles respectively, while Sunet Fulyun made the cut in the women's javelin. Finally, Chris Haramson achieved a rare milestone, winning his 20th consecutive men's national hammer throw title. The Africa hammer throw record holder is humbled.
And I was nervous today. It was funny. I always wanted to have 20. Now it's another barrier. Maybe the next one will be easier. I hope so. The stress will not be that much. But it's always very exciting and it's always nice. I'm always proud to be the best hammer thrower in South Africa. And I try to keep that spirit alive. And it's my responsibility now until the younger guys come up and take it from there. But it feels amazing. It's nice knowing you've got 20 titles in a row. It's very nice.
That was Chris Haramsa, the 20-time South Africa men's hammer throw champion, speaking in Stellenbosch, South Africa. And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports News. I'm Mark Omer in Stellenbosch, Western Cape Province in South Africa. Back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Mark. Have a good day. Here's our listener mail for this Monday morning, April 20th.
I would like to condemn in totality the act of xenophobic killings in South Africa. Let the irresponsible habit be put to an end with immediate effect. I am praying John Ushia, Obubukate Ranch, Cross River State, Nigeria.
We thank you, listener, for your comment, and please send your viewpoints to daybreakafrica@voanews.com. And that's it for this Monday, April 20th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for starting this week with us. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, I'm James Butte in Washington, hoping that all of you in Africa will make this week a very productive one.
Take your peek, watch on the television, log on to the internet, or listen right here on the radio. Hello, I am Shaka Sali, the host of Straight Talk Africa from the Voice of America.
Next on Straight Talk Africa, host Chaka Sali goes in-depth with the Sierra Leonean president, Ernest Bai Koroma. That's next, right here on VOA Africa.
Next on Let's Talk, join host Sunday Shumari and his guests discussing pets in Africa. This lighthearted show covers topics of your interest with some hilarity. Let's Talk comes to you Mondays at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.